Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
Cattle and beef supplies are getting smaller this year and will really start to tighten up in 2025.
We're forecasting beef production down by almost 1.5 billion pounds.
USDA Outlook Chairman Mark Chekanowski says that represents about a 5% decline from this year.
Just again reflecting the fact that cattle inventories are going to, they're tightening up and they're going to continue to tighten, and there's just going to be fewer cattle available to market moving into next calendar year.
Producers have been in a herd contraction mode, not holding as many heifers for breeding, but instead selling those animals for what have been very good prices. And Mark says we'll see even higher prices next year, prices averaging about 2.5% higher.
Just reflecting those tighter supplies and continued strong demand.
Mark says it could be 2027 before cattle producers begin to rebuild the beef herd. Gary Crawford, Washington.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
As I mentioned, the bipartisan infrastructure law and the IRA will add a significant extra boost to the Forest Service budget, around 30% extra for forest management each year.
On the Forest Service's FY25 budget request, Chairman of the Senate Natural Resources Committee, Joe Manchin of West Virginia.
To be honest, Chief Moore, I am frustrated how little these extra investments have moved the needle on the agency's performance metrics. I do appreciate that last year was a banner year for the Forest Service in terms of acres treated, more than 4.3 million acres. That's a million acres more than the previous year, and it sets an agency record. Some of your performance and metrics were less encouraging. For example, your timber target for last year was 3.4 billion board feet. You missed that by about 260 million board feet. You had a target of 16 improved watersheds. You only managed 6. You've told us before that it takes time to develop these projects and we should be patient. Instead of continuing to ramp up in treatments, however, the agency's target is actually going down over the next 2 years. So one of the issues I hope we'll explore today is why the historic funding provided by those two bills, the bipartisan infrastructure law and the IRA, aren't translating better into on-the-ground action. The backdrop to our discussion beyond impending fire season is a rash of sawmill closures this year, including 6 in my own home state of West Virginia. I knew that wood products markets has been especially volatile since the pandemic. We've heard a number of reports, however, that long-standing sawmills are simply running out of nearby material and need to haul logs in from further and further away, which significantly cuts into their already thin margins. More consistent and reliable offerings from local federal forests would undoubtedly help these struggling operators. What's also concerning to me about these mill closures is that the Forest Service's wildfire crisis strategy is fundamentally dependent on a robust network of mills that can process the material from our nation's forest. As we recently heard at our hearing with the Wildfire Commission, revenue-generating timber harvests are critical to pay for more complex treatments, prescribed fire and reforestation. If done right, timber harvests can provide a return to the federal taxpayer, increase the health of our forests, and support our critical industry partners. The Forest Service has used some innovative models in the past. For example, last year the agency piloted a timber transport project to salvage burned timber in California and ship it to struggling sawmills in Wyoming. That makes all the sense in the world. We shouldn't just be letting salvageable timber rot. I've said this so many times in these hearings. In the long term, Congress can also help develop markets for the small diameter timber that often comes from wildfire mitigation projects as we're thinning and cleaning. In fact, several of the provisions in a bill I introduced with Ranking Member Barrasso, the America's Revegetation and Carbon Sequestration Act, would do just that. However, we simply cannot afford to lose all of our existing mill infrastructure while that market grows. And I hope that we will hear how the Forest Service can further expand on efforts like the Timber Transport Project. Lastly, I know that the fire and forestry often get the lion's share of attention, but I also want to highlight the tremendous role that our national forest plays when it comes to our outdoor recreation economy. Last year, the 159 million visitors to Forest Service lands generated billions in economic activity and supported nearly 180,000 jobs. Unfortunately, the Forest Service has a deferred maintenance backlog of more than $7 billion, including $5 billion in maintenance just for the roads alone. This should concern all of us. The roads don't just provide access to our recreation lands, but are vital arteries for rural communities. Perhaps even more concerning, a road in poor conditions threatens our ability to deploy firefighters where they are needed and stop a wildfire before it grows to catastrophic size. As we approach the expiration of the mandatory funding for facilities maintenance that we provide in the Great American Outdoors Act, it's worth asking what changes could be made to better address the next set of hurdles facing the Forest Service.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
This is the good news slide.
Speaking recently at an American Enterprise Institute event in Washington, D.C., director of the CBO, Philip Schwagel.
So this shows the labor force, again, comparing our May 23 baseline to the February 24 baseline. And, of course, the demographic projections and then economic projections are at the foundation of the budget baseline. And this shows an important change that we made in the demographic projections. And there's a sense in which it's a change to the past. So the past is not what we thought it was, because we realized in doing the work on the demographic update toward the end of last year, we realized there's a disconnect between the numbers from DHS, the Department of Homeland Security, on the number of immigrants who are released into the interior of the United States. Those numbers seem to be disconnected from the population statistics that we get from census. And you know, it's not a criticism of census. They do a great job, and it's, you know, it's a difficult thing when things are changing so quickly, and for sure they'll get there. So this is not a criticism at all of census. But this demographic update of the surge of immigration has a huge impact on the economic projections, and therefore on the fiscal projections. And so this is just one view of it, looking at the change in the labor force. So it's over 5 million additional workers in the labor force over the budget horizon, over the 10-year budget window. And I should say, in our projections, we have the surge of immigration going from 2022, when it started, through 2026. We actually don't know when it's going to end. So, you know, what's the basis of saying 2026 was a little bit of, we're really not sure, right? Because we're not, you know, there are many factors behind the surge, conditions here, conditions in the source countries, regulatory decisions, policy decisions, social media, you know, lots of things. And it's something we're just going to have to keep watching and keep our eye on and see how long the immigration surge goes.
But why does CBO not react to illegal immigration?
There's many impacts of immigration. And what we have in our budget baseline is, in some sense, a relatively narrow view of immigration. It's the CBO view, right? So CBO, right, our job is the federal budget, right? So there's, of course, enormous impacts on state and local governments from the surge of immigration. And that's not in here. That's not in this chart. It's not in our budgetary statistics, just because that's, you know, we're certainly aware of it. It's important. Obviously, politically, it's important. Socially, it's important. It's important to, if you live in Denver, if you're the local government or local civic groups in Denver, for example, it's very important to you. I want to start by saying it's not in here. The other thing is not in here, meaning in the slides I'm going to show, are the impacts of immigration on discretionary spending. And so things like, the Border Patrol, for example, is funded by discretionary spending. So there's no, right, CBO doesn't have a view about what a future Congress will do in terms of providing resources to, you know, to agencies funded by discretionary spending. So, again, that's not in the budget baseline. If the immigration surge results in more discretionary spending in the future, well, that would be additional costs, and we'll tally them when Congress enacts it.
And this is Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
There's a ranch, it's in Gillespie County, and Gillespie County has seen really massive growth in the last few years. Part of that growth has resulted in subdivisions. So once big ranches are now being subdivided, these subdivisions now sit right next to ranches that have not been subdivided.
Melissa Hamilton is Executive Director, Government Relations, Texas and Southwestern Cattle Raisers.
What happened in this case is the Bloxhams have a ranch, and there was a ranch next to them, and the two ranchers had worked together for years, but then the ranch next to them was sold, and a developer bought that. And the developer asserted an easement. He claimed that there was an easement across the Bloxhams property, and it's important to note at this point that there is no written easement in this case.
The rancher lost And on appeal, she says,
Texas and Southwestern Cattle Raisers Association became involved. And one of the main reasons we became involved was because of that broader issue I was talking about, which is this new trend of trial courts granting easements across ranches via summary judgment. So TSCRA wrote a letter brief in support of the Bloxhams and basically said, here's the case law, here's the precedent, and for all these reasons, if you're going to force someone to have an easement across their property, you need to make that decision that an easement exists or should exist only after a trial, and that it is a mistake to grant an easement on summary judgment. So we wrote a letter in support of the Bloxhams, and the Bloxhams, and I think really property owners, ranchers across the state, had a really big win because the Court of Appeals from Amarillo reversed the trial court. They sent it back, agreeing with the Bloxhams and with TSCRA that at a minimum, that court has to hold a trial and let a jury of the Bloxham's peers decide whether an easement exists or not.
That's a case showing the importance of agreements, especially for easements. But what about mineral rights?
This is a case that is still before the courts. It's there's been a request for the Texas Supreme Court to hear this case. And it's the case that's referred to generally as the Cactus Water case. And so what this case is really about is ultimately does produced water qualify as groundwater? And the reason that's so important is because there is a long-established Texas, there's long-established Texas case law that in Texas, the landowner, the owner of the surface, owns the groundwater. So that's a longstanding principle. What has happened is that there has been a challenge to this recently that says that the challengers have said that when you're producing basically an oil and gas production, when some of that groundwater is drawn up, that it actually belongs to the oil and gas companies and not to the landowner. And obviously, TSCRA's position is no matter how you get that groundwater out of the ground, even if it's mixed in with something else, it's still groundwater and therefore belongs to the landowner and not to the oil and gas company. And so it's going to be before the Texas Supreme Court. The two lower courts have ruled in favor of the company against the landowner. And so TSCRA, along with some others, have petitioned the Texas Supreme Court for review to hear that case.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
63 million acres of our national forests high or very high risk of wildfire right now. Past year, agency treated fewer than 4 million of those 63 million acres. Your agency plans this coming year to treat even less than that.
Senator John Barrasso is the ranking member of the Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee from Wyoming, questioning the Forest Service Chief Randy Moore on the FY25 budget.
He has $63 million, last time $4 million, now less than that this year with a budget, more and more money going, getting less and less. At this declining rate, it's going to take your agency about two decades just to treat all the high-risk areas within our national forest today, but trees are going to continue to grow. Is this really a credible strategy with all the money that's been moved to the Forest Service, a credible strategy to address this wildfire crisis that Congress is clearly behind the efforts financially to help commit to get done?
Yeah, you know, Senator Barrasso, I think that we're at a crossroads in this country, and I think a part of it is that for the last 100 years, we measured our performance on acres treated. And I think what the wildfire crisis strategy has given us an opportunity to do is take a look and see, is that the right metric for performance? And when you look at how this country has changed over the last 100 years since the Forest Service existence, the number one land use in this country is wildland urban interface development. And so that has had an impact on the national forest because you have a lot of communities that are sitting adjacent to and right next to national forests. And so we have to ask ourselves, and I would love to dig deeper into this with you and this committee, what is the appropriate performance level? Is it acres treated or is it the right acres treated? And if our job is to protect communities from wildfires, we have to look at outcome-based reporting rather than output-based reporting, or at least the combination of the two. And so the outcome would be, did we protect the community from the risk of wildfire?
Well, we haven't been doing a very good job of protecting against wildfire. I mean, to me, this seems just a complete lack of urgency by the, by your department in dealing with all of this. If you don't like the results, then you change the metrics. That's ridiculous. But that's ridiculous. We don't like the results. We have more and more wildfires. We had a hearing in Washington State about what was happening a number of years ago. It doesn't seem to be improving. It doesn't seem to get better at all in spite of a massive additional expenditure of taxpayer money. We're not to say we're going to change the way the metrics is absolutely ridiculous. So Nyman Enterprises announced layoffs and the shift reduction at its Spearfish product, Forest Products facility. I understand that the owner, Jim Nyman, did everything possible to avoid the layoffs. These layoffs are a direct result of reductions to the timber sale program for the Black Hills National Forest. What's the agency doing to help retain the remaining forest products infrastructure in the Black Hills?
Yeah, you know, as I indicated earlier, we've invested about $79 million specifically to sawmills, and we've worked directly with Mr. Lyman and his facility. As a matter of fact, when we look at the Timber Transport Authority, it originated in order to help him. So we moved timber from Northern California over to Wyoming to his facility. There are market-driven conditions that are not coming into play during these discussions. And it's multiple reasons why the industry is going through a transition now, and it's not just Forest Service supply. It's market-driven conditions. It's the cost of labor that's continuing to increase. It's the lack of labor shortages. It's a number of things that's contributing to these facilities.
We're not having a labor shortage. We're having a job shortage as a result of these decisions that have been made. So I find the answer unacceptable.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
You can see in the chart is the rising share of net interest outlays in the deficit.
The director of the Congressional Budget Office, Philip Schlegel, speaking recently at an American Enterprise event in Washington, D.C., says things are actually worse than they look.
And, you know, one could say, well, look, interest rates have come up a bit, but in the future, interest rates will, you know, could go back down, and so that's not a problem. We all know about the sort of R minus G type arguments. And the challenge is that R minus G, you know, helps some, if that goes in the right direction, it helps with moderate primary deficits. But the primary deficit is no longer moderate and is not set to be moderate, out into the future. Now, the numbers here are based on our February 2024 budget and economic outlook. We are working now on the spring update. The spring goes through June 20th, so I'm pretty confident it will be spring, but it'll be late spring. And so there'll be new numbers. And I'm going to talk about some of the fiscal numbers in things that are already public. So I'm not going to go into the analysis we haven't finished. But I think the bottom line is that the next update is going to show a wider deficit. And in some sense, there's things that we know already that make it that the fiscal situation is probably worse than it looks. And this is already, it's already pretty difficult, but it's probably worse than, it's more difficult, worse than it looks.
He also has what the CBO calls the 250% problem. What is it?
The second chart, again, is familiar, showing the debt to GDP ratio going off to infinity. I promise it doesn't get better if you go past 30 years. And, we have now what we begin to call the 250% problem, which is, well, at some point, right, the debt to GDP ratio can get to a high enough value that you kind of have to look at it and think, really, is that like, is it meaningful at that point? And we've decided to truncate our y-axis now at 250% of GDP. So this one doesn't have it, but if you do a few negative shocks, then you can get a worse debt-to-GDP ratio. And, of course, you can imagine negative shocks to both the numerator and the denominator, right? The deficit, the numerator being worse, so the debt being worse, and GDP being lower, so the denominator being worse as well. And then then you really face the 250% problem.
Unfortunately, Congressional Budget Office can't offer any advice. but can say we're on thin ice.
And of course, with more debt and higher interest rates, that means that we're more vulnerable to further shocks. And so CBO published an update to our rules of thumb workbook. This is an XLS spreadsheet on our website. And you can, you know, you basically use that to say, okay, what if I make changes to the CBO budget baseline, you know, whether, you know, generally to the economics. And so I did that. And you can show that 50 basis points of higher interest rates. So if the yield on the 10-year treasury is 50 basis points higher than what CBO had in our last forecast, which is from December of last year, it comes out to an increase in the deficit of more than $1.6 trillion over the next 10 years. So it just gives you an indication of the sensitivity that we have in terms of the risk of a worse fiscal outcome.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
I've been across most of our area, and I have been up in the Panhandle as of last week, and there was quite a bit of planting going on up there. Of course, they have a May 31st deadline, and we can talk about that in a little more detail if we have time. But up in that area, there was a lot of planting ongoing.
Mark Brown is Director of Field Services with Plains Cotton Growers, looking at cotton planting progress.
Last week, as I traveled down through the southern part of our region over in the Linn and Dawson County area, there was some cotton planting going on, but it was very minimal. And I know that the conditions last week were a little bit cool, and people were waiting to see what the weather situation would be over the weekend with heavy rain forecast. And today, I am back down in the Midland and Martin County area. I have heard some reports of rainfall in the last few days. Unfortunately, it's been very spotty. And so there has been some really good rain occurrences down in this area, up to 3 inches. But I'm also likewise hearing of conditions where they only received a few tenths of an inch. So very spotty rainfall. Yesterday I was over in the Plains and Denver City area, and as you go all up that through that state line, the Texas-New Mexico state line, and it's obvious when you look at the current drought monitor at the drought conditions that we're extremely dry in that area still and in desperate need of rainfall over in that area. Most all of those counties are either in the abnormally dry up to moderate drought situation, maybe with the exception of that northernmost county of Dallam County, which does produce some cotton up there, and they do have a lot of irrigated crop up there. But otherwise, that state line is still very dry. Tony, also, I'd like to mention real quickly, I just recently looked up our Texas crop progress report that is done by the Texas branch of USDA and of NASS. And on the May 12th report, they are indicating that the estimate is that Texas is 28% planted in terms of cotton production, and that is on par with last year, also with the five-year average. So we're pretty much right on point with our planting progress for cotton. If you look at the moisture conditions that are being reported from that report for our region, up in the High Plains region, it is showing that the subsoil is 41% adequate and the topsoil is at 44% adequate. So less than half of the acres that we have in the Panhandle are what we would refer to as adequate soil moisture conditions. We're certainly in need of more rainfall over the next few weeks. And then if we look on the southern High Plains in that same report, they're estimating roughly a third, or 30% adequate on subsoil, 35% on topsoil. So we do have some rain in the forecast, and I'm certainly hoping that a lot more people will get some good, timely, and beneficial rainfall over the next few days, because certainly the calendar is marching along and the clock is ticking on this cotton crop.
And this is Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
The deficit is wide, even though the economy is doing reasonably well, right? And that's really what's unusual, right? We're past the pandemic. The fiscal response of the pandemic is mostly behind us. There's still outlays going out, of course. But the sort of emergency 2020 fiscal response is largely behind us. And yet the deficit is still wide.
Director of the Congressional Budget Office, Philip Schwagel.
Now, this was the case before the pandemic as well. You can see on the chart, if you look, you know, just before the pandemic spike in the deficit, that in 2019, we also had a structural deficit. The economy is strong. People throughout the income distribution were seeing rising incomes. And we had a structural deficit. So that's, you know, it's both familiar, but it's just different. It's different than the large deficits we've had in the past.